You are listening to Friends of Europe's podcast. Don't miss our debates on global and European issues that span political, economic, social, and environmental challenges, and follow our website at friendsofeurope.org.
Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here and a special pleasure to welcome all of you to our discussion this afternoon on Azimuth 20. And the question we're discussing is whether the challenge of connectivity, this connection between people, these networks we're all building, can help to revive and revitalize the Asia-Europe meetings. That's important. It's a relevant topic for today's globalized and very interconnected and interdependent world. I'm Shada Islam. I'm Director of Policy at Friends of Europe. And we are delighted, really, really pleased to be organizing this conference with the cooperation of the European External Action Service. And my special gratitude, really, to Michael Mathiesen and Veronika Musilova, who've been hand in hand with us while we organize this meeting. Now, as many of you here know, ASEM is a very important part of the Asia program of Friends of Europe. It may have been launched in 1996, but I believe that ASEM is very relevant, very credible as a 21st century construct. This meeting is being held. It's not a coincidence that we're doing it now. Obviously, we're all back from a long vacation, but it's really because in November, Luxembourg will be hosting a foreign ministers meeting, and we have Marc Ongerhauer here from the Luxembourg Foreign Ministry who will talk to us a little bit about the meeting in Luxembourg and the plans they have to try and start this process of reviving ASEM. Of course, next year in Mongolia, in Ulaanbaatar in July, there will be the summit, the 20th anniversary celebrations of ASEM. And we want to make sure that we're really celebrating something in Ulaanbaatar next July. So I hope we have an exciting and informative hour ahead, 4 hours ahead, actually, of discussions today on enhancing connections. Now, why connectivity? As you can see from the commentary we've just published, we really believe that this conversation between Asia and Europe has been going on for a very long time, and it needs to be enhanced, to be consolidated, to really bring ASEM together onto a new, more energized track. Now, connectivity is part of our world. It's part of the EU agenda. We'll be talking about that. We haven't yet called it connectivity, but it's very much part of our single market, of our ideas of bringing the transport networks together, building a digital Europe as well. ASEAN, of course, has its connectivity master plan, and that has become a bit of a beacon for the rest of the world. We all follow it very closely, and we'll be talking about it also, especially in the latter part of our discussion. China has come up with a very ambitious One Belt, One Road initiative, and that is also about connecting countries, regions, provinces, cities. And the EU and China are going to set up a joint connectivity platform very shortly. So there's that happening as well. What we believe ASEM can do is bring all of these different conversations into one coherent, consistent whole, and of course do its own work on it as well. Now, as you'll see, that we've been talking for a long time about reviving ASEM, and we think connectivity offers the way forward in this. It will not automatically transform ASEM, make it more vibrant or more dynamic, but it will sharpen ASEM's focus. We've all said it is much too general. It'll sharpen that focus. It will enhance its credentials as an incubator of new ideas. I think this is especially important as we talk about the future. And it meets some of the demands we've had throughout these years of a more tangible ASEM, an ASEM that delivers. And of course, that question, that perennial question about visibility for ASEM. And I think, you know, this thing, this concept, this buzzword, if you like, brings it all together. The challenge, of course, and we'll be talking about that during our panel, is to turn these words into action. So our first panel is going to discuss these and other issues. It's going to focus on transport and infrastructure connectivity, trucks and ships and planes and trains, as we talked about in our program. Let me introduce our panel to you. It's a very enlightened and, I have to say, knowledgeable panel, people who've been working on the ground and on policy on these issues. Let me start off with Andres Bildovagic. Latvian Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs. Latvia recently hosted ministerial meetings on transport and education, and Andres will talk to us a little bit about that. Thank you very much for flying in from all over the world today, Andres. We're grateful that you're here. Ambassador Zhang Zhaoyang, Zhang Kang, doesn't really need to be introduced at an ASEM seminar. She's the ASEM senior official at the Chinese Foreign Affairs Ministry and one of the leading proponents of a revitalized and energetic ASEM. Thank you, Ambassador, for being here as well. Henrik Hololai didn't come from too far, but actually he did. He's the former Estonian Minister for the Economy and, of course, today Director General for Mobility and Transport at the European Commission. Henrik, thank you for being here. I think it's one of your first transport discussions in Brussels, so we're grateful that you decided to come. Paulo Costa, President of the Venice Port Authority. He's a former mayor of Venice and Italian Minister for Public Works. So thank you very much, Paolo, for being here as well. Uwe Löschner, Vice President for Business Development East Region at Deutsche Bahn, Schenker Rail. Thank you also for coming. Obviously very interested in ASEM. They've come all the way from their respective countries. And last but not least, Miodrag Besut. He is from the United Nations Commission for Europe and has been working on these issues of transport for a very long time. So that's it from me. Rules of the game, very simple. Those who know Friends of Europe know the rules of the game. I'll be putting a question to each of our panelists first. I will give them 5 minutes to answer these questions. I may have a follow-up. And since we want this to be a very interactive discussion, I really want to open the floor to all of you. All of you know a great deal about ASEM, have made comments about it, are involved in it. Many ASEM senior officials are here. So let's have it. Let's have the conversation flowing. So let me start off with the first question. Andres, you agreed to be the first person to answer the question. I said in my introduction that you have held in Latvia several meetings on transport and education. And I was wondering, yes, it's on. It's on. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about those meetings and also whether you agree with our thesis that ASEM can move forward if connectivity becomes a major element of its future work.
Well, Shada, thank you so much for the invitation, and we are very grateful for being part of the discussion. And first of all, I would like to express profound appreciation to the Friends of Europe and to the External Action Service for convening this event together with the Luxembourgish Presidency. Indeed, we are full believers in the ASEM format, and we believe that connectivity is the right approach, right word, right concept. And during our 6 months of fame at the top of the EU Council, we were very much engaged in bringing forward this innovative concept. I think we should not be shy of the current achievements. This concept has grown from 6 countries to more than 50, 53 during the last 12 months. 2 more countries joined this concept, Croatia and Kazakhstan. And I think we have fairly strong wind in the sails. And the wind is there because of the understanding that connectivity is the answer. To paraphrase the famous expression about globalization, that if you avoid globalization, it doesn't crash you, but leaves you out. I think with connectivity, same could be said. And I think among the stakeholders, we have increased understanding that this is the right approach. And I would like to commend the very detailed, well-thought recommendations what you have put together to the decision makers, stakeholders in the government, in the business, in the public sphere. To be more specific, I think we definitely have realization on both sides of the Eurasian continent that trade has to be moved forward. I think we have a very strong empirical data that movement towards free trade agreements between Europe and Asian countries is the right key. Empirical data on South Korean agreement is present everywhere. We have moved very strongly with Vietnam. As you know, we are discussing preliminary investment protection agreements with China and some new ideas about free trade with the People's Republic of China. So trade definitely forces us to think about innovative ways. And in that respect, of course, traditional and non-traditional means of transportation become a very, very crucial point. And of course, for Latvia, as a geographically frontline state of the European Union, it was quite an obvious choice to put ASEM on the forefront of our presidency. And I think we have been quite satisfied with the two ministerial on transportation and on education. Of course, without education, without awareness, we hardly can make right business strategies. So we tried to focus on those two fronts, and we also wanted to be as much as active as possible to involve countries of Central Asia, countries of Eurasia in our conversation. Because if we focus just on Europe or just on Asia and forget countries in the middle, we might have a missing link. And therefore, we are very pleased that Kazakhstan is also part of our discussions on this. During these last 6 months, Kazakhstan has joined WTO. Yeah. It's a very positive development. And within EU, we have adopted revision of Central Asia strategy. We have restored position of special representative for Central Asia. Peter Burian, distinguished Slovak diplomat, is in charge of this development, and I think this is a very important indicator. We tried also to involve Russia in our discussions, despite all geopolitical turmoil and disagreements on Ukraine. We were pleased to see both Russian ministers in Riga during those discussions, and I think this is also an element. We are not backing down on... it's not an appeasement, it's not... that we are changing our policy regarding Ukraine, regarding annexation of Crimea. But of course, when it comes to education, when it comes to technicians, it's important that all 53 countries are involved. The fourth element priority during our presidency has been digital economy. Digital economy, digital market within European Union, how to connect EU28. And of course, we have to involve as much as possible this subject in our conversations at the ASEM. Talking about cyber, talking about e-commerce threats, challenges, some negative situations that we have encountered in the past, not sort of polishing the reality, but dealing with the issues which might open additional business opportunities, untapped potential for trade, including e-commerce between Asia and Europe. This might be a little bit telegraphic overview, but unfortunately, presidency lasted only 6 months, but we are very confident that the Luxembourgish government will carry on the ball. Latvia remains engaged in the transport working group. Our experts and ministers are meeting in Seoul as we speak, today and tomorrow. And I have full confidence that we are on the right track. And even geopolitical situations and slowdown in some of the markets have not lessened the appetite for our work.
Thank you, Andres. So you've put the focus very much on the trade boosting powers, if you like, of connectivity and also the inclusive element, and very clearly also digital. I was wondering for Ulaanbaatar, in terms of the physical infrastructure, transport, connectivity, are you already in the process of drawing up some ideas that you will take there?
I think we have a number of ideas. Of course, they will be discussed in Seoul very specifically. I think we have to put together, discuss ideas coming from different headquarters and different capitals. Chinese government has a lot of to offer. We have ideas about One Belt, One Road approach. We have a framework for discussions about infrastructure, railway connectivity on the basis of 16 plus 1. Countries of Central Eastern Europe discussing with with China. We have some regional ideas. Rail Baltica is definitely one of the very hot subjects right now in the region, seeing how we can connect better eastern flanks of the European Union with the sort of core markets of the European Union here in Western Europe. And this is the project for the next 3-5 years to be implemented. So many, many well-thought ideas on the table, and I'm sure that this week we will make progress.
Mm. Thank you very much. So we will talk about the practicalities of these different ideas in a minute, but I'll turn now to Ambassador Zhang. And Ambassador Andres has already said that many of the ideas on connectivity have actually emerged from Beijing. And recently there was a very important, I think, very big seminar in Chongqing on industrial connectivity. And I was wondering if you could just give us a few highlights of that meeting.
Okay, thank you. First of all, I would like to thank Friends of Europe as well as External Service of EU to organize this very important conference at such an important and opportune time for the ASEM. And Chongqing ASEM Industry Dialogue on Connectivity is a highly successful one. When we say highly successful one, it's because first, it's the first full-fledged efforts in connectivity, because when we say full-fledged, it is first time for almost all the stakeholders together, and from 40 members of the ASEM and 600 representatives from government, from business circle, as well as from the academia, to discuss how to advance, you see, connectivity. And furthermore, the subjects are far beyond the traditional transport and sense of that connectivity. Many also involve the, as just now the minister said, the digital and the invisible, the hard and the soft things as well. And furthermore, the conference, I should say it's conference, was opened by the Executive Vice Premier of the Chinese government, Zhang Gaoli, and the political weight and importance was first signified by the 33 deputy and ministers of the high-ranking officials from our ASEM member states as well. So you can see it's really full-fledged. And the results are impressive. Altogether, I'll just give you the headings of the six major key proposals. The first one is to enhance the intellectual connectivity between Asia and Europe, the first heading. Then the second key proposal heading is to forge an open trade and investment regime. The third one is to promote an innovative financing markets and financing mechanisms as well. The fourth one is to promote the ultimate, actually to deepening the people-to-people contacts. And also, the next one is to improve the policy communications and the coordination mechanisms. So all these are fairly broad subjects. From this, one can see the unique feature of the connectivity. That is, it's very comprehensive, very broad, and very deep, and inclusive as well. So the connectivity is not only capable of, you see, indicating the way forward for all of us, but also capable of providing people very specific platforms to work on in this way to advance the connectivity. And anyhow, so the conclusion of the people attending that, you see, conference thought that the connectivity should stay as the centrality for within the ASEAN to advance the cooperation in the next decade. That's all about Chongqing initiative. That's the highlights. Yeah, thank you.
Ambassador, thank you very much. But I do want to follow up because Chongqing was not just one-off. I think China has been among the countries, along with India, pushing for a working group, a joint ASEAN working group on connectivity. And I was wondering, why do you think this is important? Is it to keep the momentum up? And in which case, is that something that you will formally suggest tomorrow in Luxembourg or in Ulaanbaatar?
And that's a really crucial question to ask and to be answered. I think the, you see, I remember in your conference, one of the, your conference indications said, asked, is the connectivity a credible recipe for reviving and reinforcing ASEAN? And I think my answer could be yes, but only when the real actions are taken. Then at the first step of the real actions, I think, is to set up a working group on the connectivity. Why we propose that? Because that would be the, you see, first time to connect all the stakeholders together in an organized manner. And also that can engage all the stakeholders in a comprehensive and systematic manner and way. And because in this way, the role of all the stakeholders can be brought into full play. Then as a group, the working group, the function of the necessary coordinating role would be very helpful to ensure the smooth running of the connectivity. And furthermore, it is important to keep the institutional memory for the connectivity efforts to be going on, because I would like to use a metaphor here. The connectivity efforts and the cooperation may like a long march, and it can be carried on and on for years. So it's very important for a working group to keep an eye on it, to avoid, you see, the overlapping efforts, and to make the efforts the most efficient and effective. I think that's why. Thank you.
Thank you very much. In fact, indeed, it is said often that ASEAN doesn't really have an institutional memory and that things get lost in translation, as it were. So thank you very much, Ambassador, for giving us some insights into why we're pushing, you are pushing, ASEAN wants a working group. Henrik, a lot of talk here, a lot of ambition, a lot of vision, if you like. How realistic is it really to talk, as Andres did, about the Eurasia transport systems, about the connectivity between Asia and Europe in the different ways that we've discussed so far? Realistic?
Yes. First of all, shout out. Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me, and both to you and to the Friends of Europe. It's really a pleasure and an honor to be here, and also to see such distinguished audience and a lot of interest in these subjects. Perhaps also a small correction to your introduction. I mean, I'm still the Director General for Mobility and Transport in Waiting. I only start in the beginning of October. So,
we anticipated, friendly.
Yeah, indeed. And also the reason why I was very, very pleased to be invited is that I do consider the cooperation between the between Europe, European Union, and Asia as a very important priority also for the next years to come, and also for me as the Director General for Transport. So in that sense, I have to be obviously replying to your question that it is very realistic to improve the connectivity between Asia and Europe, and actually. There is a relatively low base, to be honest, to build on. I mean, if we also look at the overall European presence, in the wider scale in Asia, and in particular in Southeast Asia, then we actually realized that Europe's presence is not that significant, be it business, but also be it the political presence as such. I think we can do much more. And also when you talk to the people, it's clear that one of the ways how to reach out and one of the ways how to build actually a stronger partnership is particularly through connectivity and through facilitating the activities in that particular domain. And we actually doing quite a number of things which are ongoing. I mean, we have to see, of course, we have to have a holistic approach. We have to see also all the different transport mode in that context. I mean, we all know the very high intensity of the maritime trade, and which is very natural. But at the same time, I see immense benefits when it comes, for example, the aviation sector. I mean, Asia Pacific is today by far the fastest growing aviation region in the world, and especially in the next 15 years, it's going to more than triple its present number of passengers and flights. So Europe has to tap in if it wants to be in the real growth markets. Because if you look at Europe, then for example, in the aviation sector, we have competitive airlines, but we are not really tapping into the markets where the growth is generated in the next years to come, and it's absolutely essential in order to maintain the position globally. If we look at the other transport modes, for example, then I mean, there is a lot of talk about the terrestrial transport and to see how we can build better links, and I think that was also very. A very wise point that was made by Andres before when he said that that we should not forget the countries which are kind of in between. It's absolutely essential, especially when we talk about the terrestrial transport, and to make sure that there are actually functioning land links as well. And that also leads to the issue about the investments that have to be made, and also not only the financial side of the investments, but also the regulatory side of the investments, and also to make sure that the quality of the investments is also delivering an outcome which is something which is in line with the standards that we have here in Europe and also in Asia. I mean, in a way, it is also part of the regulatory convergence and of course part of the much wider cooperation which needs to take place within the political framework, within the people-to-people contacts, and within the general intensification of the relationship between European Union and ASEAN, I mean, that respect. But clear. And then, of course, we have the rail transport, where I also see quite a lot of benefits and the developments. I mean, we see I'm sure that colleague here in the panel will talk more about it, but there are a lot of positive developments already taking place, and the potential is clearly there, and of course for the different transport modes you also have the different delivery times, and actually for all the different delivery times you also have the different kind of products, and I do believe that for all the transport modes actually the market is clearly developing. It all of course leads to the fact how can we actually also do more when it comes to the cooperation in area of investments, and also to try to see how we can work together. I mean, for Europe, the infrastructure investments are actually a very significant part of the growth. I mean, it's a very significant part of the Juncker plan. I mean, the creation of the EFSI. We have also seen at the same time, of course, the creation of the Asian Development Bank. And for both investments in the infrastructure will in the future remain significant parts of the investment portfolio. And there again, building trust, building good cooperation, trying better to utilize the existing, as always, limited financial resources is definitely a challenge that we have to face, and something which would help to make closer connectivity between Asia and Europe even more realistic.
Very much. Thank you very much, Henrik. As Ambassador Jiang said, it's a long road. And you talked, I think, very importantly about regulatory convergence and connectivity and standards. I was wondering, a lot of Asian colleagues say what Europe has achieved in terms of its connectivity is the gold standard for what the rest of the world can aspire to. And, you know, we believe very much in sharing, and Friends of Europe, we believe very much in sharing best practice and sharing our ideas and thoughts. So you think that we in Europe have our lessons here that can be shared more extensively with Asians? and vice versa, possibly.
I think we have to be open to all the experiences. And, of course, in many areas, Europe standards are very high and can be used as best practice. But we should at the same time also be very open to learn from our partners elsewhere. It's probably true to say that in many of the infrastructure investments, we have put the bar very high, and we also aim not only for providing the simple connectivity, but it comes with additional elements. I mean, there is also a lot of focus on safety. There is also a lot of focus also on security. I mean, these are the kind of elements which actually altogether would contribute to something which can be characterized as the gold standard as such. And Europe, of course, has quite a long experience in the infrastructure investments and also has been developing it further. I mean, the creation of the Connecting Europe facility during the previous college, and which is now also integral part of our transport investment program, has been something which is actually taking into account all these different elements. It's like, you know, it's not enough to have a road. It's also important, for example, to have the safe parking for the trucks. It's also important to have a very high quality of this road infrastructure and the certain criteria which have been set. And I think this is something where every country, of course, outside Europe has to see how that would fit with its own practice. But clearly, the learning from certain our best practices is something that we are more than happy to share, and which should be part of the partnership that we are trying to create.
Including with the New Asian Investment Infrastructure Bank.
Absolutely.
Yeah, right. Thank you very much, Henrik. No, Paolo, so we've talked a lot about the different modes of transport, and yes, it works. It works. Different modes of transport, a lot of focus on terrestrial, on trains and railways, etc. So, and you are from the Venice Port Authority, so give us a little bit of an idea of, you were also in Riga for the discussions, give us an idea of why the VPA is interested in ASEM connectivity.
I could answer very briefly, in the sense that since since 6 months, we have been flooded by question about this, just because our Chinese friends decided to put Venice on a map, on the one road, one belt one road, there is the final destination is Venice and Duisburg. So with my friend Eric Stacke, we are always flooded by, everybody is asking us why. So that's something that's coming to some more realistic approach. I decided to have two ways of answering this question. One was asking my Chinese friends, why did you say so? And the second one, to study a little bit the situation. Because when I asked my Chinese friends, why you did so, In the first time I thought, okay, that's because of Marco Polo, that's something, you know, let's go back to... He says, no, that's not true. There's something much more interesting. And so, if I can say just briefly, there are three main, statement I can say. First of all, if you look at Europe was, well, our Europe in the sense the European Union was built on intra-EU trade. Mm-hmm. Well, the intra-EU trade, the external trade from Europe, so the trade towards not intra-Europe, was less than 50% in 2008. Now it's more than 65%. And according to some computation that we made, because we have to understand what's going on, in 2026, there will be much more external trade from Europe to the rest of the world than within Europe. Okay. If you just, for instance, just for giving you an idea, for my country, for Italy, it will be in 2017, not 2000. So it will be next year. What does it mean? It means that if you have to deal, to trade with countries that are very far from them, well, there is two ways, two modes. One is going east by land somewhere, and that's one of the Chinese ideas of coming by land. The other one is going by sea. So the second point is we have to expect a lot of pressure on the ports, on the European ports, in the next 10, 15 years. So we estimated that by 2030, there will be more than tripled the pressure on the ports. And which ports? And so we went down. And we find out that, okay, the larger part, or the most growing part, of even the maritime traffic, it towards Asia. So Europe-Asia is the first one connection that we have to look at if you want to understand what will happen in this idea. There is a technicality. Only on the connection between Europe and Asia, people are deploying these so-called very mega ships. Ships that will be can carry more than 18,000 TEU cannot go to the United States because even the Panama Canal, when will be open next year, will be only for 14,000. So there is also a vested interest in those dealing with this kind of traffic to look what's happening in this direction. Well, the Suez Canal is no problem, so we can go there. And then you enter, if you come from China, you enter the Mediterranean from the Suez Canal. We used to imagine that we were also going immediately out from Gibraltar to come back to Europe from the north. Well, even this is changing. Now it's more than 56% of the good of the containers. I'm just talking about containers, but it is almost even worse. From this point of view, from the rest, they remain within the Mediterranean, in the sense they go to Europe through some Mediterranean ports, with some Mediterranean or Black Sea ports and so on, and we were looking which were the best way of going there, and then we came to my friend. He says, okay, the shortest route is through the Adriatic. Not only the shortest route through the Adriatic from the maritime point of view, but it's also the shortest route from the land. Because if you look what's happening in Europe now, industry moved eastward. And if you look where is... So if you had to try to catch from the Mediterranean this kind of customers, the best way is going there. And then you go down. So if you go there, what does it mean, not Adriatic? It means a couple... four or five ports, which means our ports, the port of Ravenna, the port of Trieste, as Italia is concerned, but also the port of Coppa, the port of Rijeka, and so on. And that's why we have established since 4 years a so-called North Adriatic Port Association. We are trying to deal together in these things. So but that's we realized that what was until recently our hope is becoming a little bit more a reality because somebody else from outside is telling to us, no, you have to hurry up, guys, because we are coming very soon. And, you know, if we are coming, we are not just coming for a few peanuts. We have to prepare be more ambitious, begin with much project. That's why we try to create a new... So this is not the right place to talk about that. We invented some way a new... innovative port system that can accommodate larger vessel without destroying the existing port facilities, which is not a problem and not to discuss here. But anyhow, that's the, I'll say, the logic chain that we have to follow to understand, and we are very, very much alive in this perspective, and that's why we are even more interested in that than I used to be.
Paolo, thank you very much. That's very, very insightful indeed. I just have a quick follow-up for you. I mean, you're obviously banking on a continuously buoyant Europe-Asia trade. So is everyone else, I guess. Did the crisis not show a certain slowdown in this activity?
No, I have to say that I used to say to my friends that if I had been confined in my room, in my office, since 2008 until now, without reading any newspaper, looking at the TV and so on, just looking at what's happening in my port, I have to say, oh, everything is fine. Because we were always growing. Of course, we were getting some more share instead of... so there was no growth around.
Oh, yeah.
But because, you know, I come back to the other fact. Because of this fact that we are in the right place, it's not because of us. We are not because we I could say that we were more efficient, we were more alive, we were much able to do a better marketing and so on. Not true. It's just because, well, not true. We try our best, but it's not for that. We were in the right place, the right moment, and so that's. And I presume that we could be in the right place, in the right moment for the next 20 years on behalf of Venice, of Italy, and I do believe also in the behalf of Europe and Asia from this point of view. Mm.
Thank you very much. So the competition now, Uwe. From shipping to trains and railways, is there competition between the two? Can both grow at the same pace? And tell me a little bit about how important will railways, high-speed railways and the rest of it be in this connected ASEM?
Okay. Thank you very much for the invitation to explain that there is not a competition at the moment. There's enough cargo in Asia to bring to Europe, to bring to other places in the world. And if there is a little bit of competition by this rail product, it is a competition with the air freight. Why? We started in our company the railway connection to China, from China to Europe in 2008. And we had a lot of people, they said, hey, what are you doing? And really, it was an experiment at this time. Today, it's not. In these 8 years, one of the places in Germany is more important or more famous as Berlin, that is just not named Duisburg, because that is the direction place of his trains. We started with some trains a month. In this year, we have approximately 500 trains from China, mainland, into Europe, especially into Duisburg and into Hamburg, and approximately 100 trains from Europe eastbound going to China. The last years shows that we have a growth of every year of approximately 25 up to 30%. That means this product is coming on. Why? Why it is interesting? Why it is coming on? It is coming on especially for three reasons. The first reason is we can deliver from China door to door to Europe approximately in 16 up to 19 days. That is interesting for every company because it is it has an influence of CapEx and also for the marketing campaigns of the large global players. But it is also interesting, and it is more and more also an argument for us in our marketing, that this railway connection between Asia and Europe gives for the CO2 footprint a lot of arguments for a lot of companies. That is a question also of environmental. And in this case, okay, we are a little bit a competitor for the ocean freight people, yeah, and in the shipping industry. But however, we have just now developed products which are interesting not only for producers of electronics, which is quite valuable cargo. We have just now also developed products for small companies, for mid-sized companies, and that is really changing logistic supplies between Asia and Europe. And that is interesting. And that is the main force for the future, what we are expecting for the future development on this land plot. We also learned, and that is a learning process also in our company, this product is only possible with a cooperation of a lot of different people, different cultures, different structures. You have to go across borders, you have to go across mountains, 4,000 meters. In winter just now, sometimes minus 40, 45 degrees. You have across borders with customs clearance processes and so on and so on different cultures of understanding or of values. And you have to bring together people. Our slogan is just now not to produce railway between Asia and Europe. Our slogan is, we are closing the distance. What includes not only the cargo flow or the transportation, what includes especially also the communication and bringing together people and procedures, technologies, cultures, and ideas for new innovations. And I think that is the main result of this new product what we have. And maybe in this kind, we are very, very personalized, related also to our colleagues which are organizing the ocean freight and the air freight. But all the three kinds of transportation between Asia and Europe will bring the continents together and will bring a result for everybody of us.
Mm. Thank you very much, Uwe. You've really very, I think, vividly actually described the different kinds of consultation, coordination that is required. Isn't that going to be a monumental task? And how are you going to be able to bring together these different cultures and clearance systems and different topographies, geographies? How's it going to happen?
It is a process, and it's quite difficult to explain it in some minutes. What does it mean? We started to found a joint venture with our colleagues from the Russian Railways. That was the beginning in 2008. Via this way, we were very, very well connected also to the people in this part between, in Central Asia, in Central Asian countries. And after when we founded also a joint venture with our colleagues in China, especially the colleagues in Chongqing, were really also pioneers on the Chinese side to develop something what is going out of China with own trains, with own platforms, with own wagons, to build up own infrastructure and to learn how the Europeans are thinking in the direct communication. We are very, very well connected.
Mm.
We have a lot of meetings. It takes a lot of time. Mm. And if it would be easy, everybody would do it. But we think not as a competitive, as a competition. What the pioneers had done in the past is basically existing and can be used today also by our companies. And in this way, the competition is just also starting up.
Mm. Thank you very much. I'm sure there'll be questions on some of those aspects. Mirdrag, you're the expert at the United Nations, talking about these issues, writing about them, discussing them. You've been listening patiently, and I hope with interest, to everything you've heard so far. What is your initial reaction to what you've heard? This is realistic, too ambitious, the projects are worth doing, trade is on the way up, ASEM can be revived through this process?
First, thank you very much for inviting me and UN in a way to speak. I must say that I'm a little bit withheld about the euphoria, so to speak, if I may. The life is moving on whether you connect or not connect. I will say a few words about where I come from, the institution where I come from, so that you may better understand what the UN has to do with transport. You heard about humanitarian things, crises, wars and peace, and so on. But, you know, United Nations Economic Commission for Europe was established in 1947 to rebuild Europe. There was no EU then. There was no Central Asia or China in a today's sense. What the institution where I come from was doing then was linking countries of Europe, rebuilding roads, rebuilding railways, making blueprints which exist today. If you drive on the road outside of Brussels to, I don't know, Netherlands or France, you will see road sign E30, E40, E50. That's the UNEC that has done it. If you see the road sign which says speed limit, that's the UN. If you look at your vehicle, at the windshield of your vehicle, you will see a small E sign. That's the UNEC. There are a lot of things that have been done in terms of development of transport sector. If you look at the road safety regulations, they're coming from Vienna Convention, which is called Vienna because it was signed in Vienna, but it is a UN convention on road signs and signals, and many, many other things. Now, to move closer to today, in the last 10, 15 years, when the situation and the political situation in Europe started to change, it was realized then that the interest of Asian countries to become better connected with core of Europe is growing. At that time, that was beginning of 2000, a group of countries, we are governmental organization, group of countries sat together and said, well, let's look at the way how best we could use the infrastructure that we already have and connect among neighbors and between Asia and Europe. So this project that countries and we with the countries have been working on for about 13 years now is in the last, I believe, last third phase. So what has been done? I will go directly into metro, but there are other things that you may be interested to hear. So what has been done? In the first phase, the countries sat together, discussed the existing infrastructure, realized that it's not only the infrastructure that is missing, but many other things. And I heard from some of colleagues here what they mentioned about the regulatory aspect of connectivity. Which I believe is even more important. So they developed 9 rail and road corridors, which are priority from their national perspective, but also from the international perspective, and identified actually the priority plans for this infrastructure. There are about 310 projects, road, rail, inland navigation, ports, worth about $215 billion. For most of them, or large majority of them, countries are submitting requests to financial institutions to get financed. Now, personally, I think that the much bigger problem is non-physical obstacles to connectivity. My colleague from railways would probably know that you have a different railway gauge from China to Europe, and you have to change it twice or three times en route, which slows down railways, which are making fantastic effort to reach Europe from China in 19 days, and they could probably do it in 14 without this. Then you have custom controls, border controls, which are unharmonized. For all of this, I'm not saying we have panacea in UN, but there are international UN agreements that could help. We have TIR convention that works well in most of the countries. I would say in all 50-something signatories, and China is about to announce that it's joining TIR Convention. Pakistan joined in July. So these useful tools which can improve connectivity, remove non-physical barriers, are there. Mm. So it's up to countries to use them. You, I guess, through your activities, could also promote these existing tools and things that could improve even, you know, with a smaller investment, low-hanging fruits, without major billion-dollar investments in blue elephants and so on and so forth, that could improve the situation. There are concrete projects, both in terms of physical infrastructure, which countries are striving to achieve, but those regulatory impediments are there, and information about the possibility to solve them, resolve them, are not always present in the countries.
But discussions on these regulatory, these non-physical obstacles that you spoke about, and rightly so, those discussions are ongoing.
Yes, yes. This is the third phase.
It's on.
This is the third phase of this project that I mentioned, Eurasian Transport Links. In this third phase, actually, the idea is to operationalize the lines and links and corridors that were identified, to look at nature of freight that is going through maritime and inland transport corridors, and to deal with these non-physical obstacles, whether they come from customs side or transport side or other controls that borders. We have now a major obstacle, for example, for railways, was the absence of a single railway law that would govern transport from, let's say, Asia to Europe. All other transport modes have a law that regulates the obligation of consignor and consignee. You know, when you ship something by airplane, you don't have to worry about. When the, you know, road transport doesn't have the problem. Railways was the only one which had a problem because it had two laws regulating. Now in UN, we are working on that and hopefully close enough to solve the issue and have a single railway law that would govern the railway traffic between East and West.
Thank you very much. So a dose of reality into our discussion. So thank you very much indeed for that, Mir Drag, as well. So now we have half an hour for questions from yourselves, comments. My plea, as always in these occasions, is to please keep it short and snappy so we get more of a discussion going. We have panelists who are very happy to respond to your questions. If you please put up your hand, I have colleagues in the room who have roving microphones and will come to you. And if there's a question specifically to one of the panelists, please say so as well. So I know this is always the moment of truth when we see hands go up, but I would urge you really to use this opportunity to ask questions. So floor is yours. Who will be the first person to ask a question of our colleagues? Yes, please. Would you please wait for, and please do identify yourselves.
I'm a senior official from Brunei.
Nice to meet you.
Just want to make comments. In 1996, when leaders of Europe and Asia met, connectivity is the issue that they discussed. They were talking about increased trade between Asia and Europe, increased connectivity in terms of Trans-Asia-Europe Railway, and increased air transportation as well as sea. I think this is not new, only now we use buzzwords, connectivity. It was already been targeted, it was already been discussed, but the problem is at that time is the political and economic situation doesn't allow us to move forward as what we want to do. Because of the financial crisis in 1999 and 2008. But now is the right time for us to enhance further the connectivity and the relationship between Europe and Asia. And with the AIIB, as well as One Road, One Belt, I think this is an opportunity for us to develop and make the Asia-Europe a more prosperous region. Mm-hmm. For the future.
Thank you very much. But in fact, the point you raised of political and economic situation hasn't really gone away. There are still enormous challenges as regards the political, economic, social conditions across the world. So I think to push this idea at this point takes a lot of imagination and creativity and courage, if I may say so. So thank you for doing that, Ambassador.
And if I may, I would like to say a few words in response to what comments from our Brunei colleague. I think it's very important for him to provide a bit of history since 1996. Also, the mention has been made of the AIIB. You see, just not long ago, I had a very good meeting with the Secretary for establishing AIIB and discussed the possibility of establishing some sort of cooperative arrangement between ASEM and AIIB when it enter into force by the end of this year. And Mr. Jin, that's the Secretary of the AIIB, responded very positively and said to me, that's okay, I should do so because, you see, out of 57 of the founding members of the AIIB, 37 are from the ASEM. So that's a very big percentage of this. That indicates the internal connectivity between AIIB and ASEM. So that's a piece of information for our friends here to notice that later on we should discuss that the sort of cooperative arrangement between ASEM and AIIB on the basis of consensus within the ASEM. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ambassador. Any other questions and comments from the floor? Yes, please, Jonathan.
Thank you. I'm Jonathan Peel. I'm a member of the European Economic and Social Committee and produced the opinion that we did on Central Asia. So thank you to the Latvian presidency for their emphasis on Central Asia. I think if we're talking about infrastructure connectivity, and in particular the overland route, there's one aspect we haven't touched on yet this afternoon, and that is energy and pipelines. And I'd be very interested in the comments of each of the panelists about the importance of making sure there is proper energy connections between Europe and Asia, because we all need a secure supply of energy to live, for work, for jobs, for our standards of living. And so I'd be very interested in bringing energy into this argument. Thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan. Andres, would you like to comment on that?
Well, thank you so much for the compliment to the presidency. And indeed, I would say one more sentence on Central Asia as one of the important links between our two continents. Of course, we have to keep this focused attention because the strategy has been adopted since 2007, but yeah. We made a review this year, and UN has done a lot, many, many good programs. BOMCA, one of them, integrated border management system in Central Asia, has been supported by UN, has gone through 8 phases, but we need to continue these efforts to remove bottlenecks for trade, for transportation, including energy, through the countries of Central Asia. They have to be present as much as possible in our discussions. These discussions have to be inclusive. And we mentioned a little bit digital, internet connections, all sorts of all kind of modern means of communication going through these countries. They are part of our debate, even if they are not formally members of ASEM, but we wish that they are present.
Henrik, would you like to come in on this as well? Anyone else from the panel? I'd be very happy to take your comments.
Thank you very much, Shada. Concerning the energy topic, I mean, clearly it's important to develop the cooperation. But I think that the issue there is probably Central Asia, because if we go further on, we are both. I mean, further on, Asia and Southeast Asia are energy importers, as is Europe, so there is not much we can trade to each other, but we both can actually benefit from Central Asia with relatively significant reserves. And I think that both Asia on their own side and Asia Pacific or Southeast Asia and Europe on its own side is trying to build these links. I mean, for Europe, the cooperation in particular with a number of Central Asian countries, and also to that respect, Azerbaijan is something which is part of the overall energy union concept, and where I absolutely consider essential for Europe to increase its security supply and also to reduce its dependency from the hydrocarbons that we are buying from the Russian Federation. So clearly this is absolutely essential. On the other side is as well. I mean, if you look at it from the point of view of China, Southeast Asia, then it's clear that they also want to diversify their sources. So there, probably the cooperation could be perhaps developed on the renewable side. And I think that there also there is a possibility for the exchange of know-how and also perhaps the best practices. I mean, solar energy as just one example, but also hydro energy in China is very, very far developed. So there are also additional potential for cooperation. Thank you.
Yes, please, Miodra.
Thank you. I'm not an expert on energy and transport, but I will tell you what I know and what I think is important. I understand the huge, huge, enormous need of Europe to ensure secure, safe sources of energy. But as it was said, you know, there is a interest coming from many sides for the limited amount of energy available. So perhaps if so much efforts in securing energy would be put in finding alternative energies and finding ways to reduce dependency on the carbon-based energy, that would perhaps, you know, reduce the overall pressure on looking around where the energy can come from. Yes, UN has been doing a good job, but, you know, the let's say the way where the pipelines go is purely political question. It doesn't have anything to do with the economy. Yeah. To my understanding.
Yeah. Anyone else? Paolo, Uwe, would you like to comment? You don't have to.
No. Well, we are dealing with the energy issue from a different point of view. It's mainly, as a port, we are mainly connected with the new logistic of LNG, which is a way of making more flexible the possibility to utilize different sources of energy. because the previous idea to have these huge transcontinental pipelines, well, they was not so much secure, I would say, just to be, let's say, polite, and yes, and the fact that now there is much more easy to make use new technologies, not only in distributing worldwide the LNG, but also to have a consumer distribution. The problem is how to develop the market. The idea we are following, the idea we're trying to I could even elaborate on it, but it's not the right time, the right place. The problem is, how can we distribute LNG before gasify it? Okay, so if we can maintain the LNG as it is, up to home, up to the truck, up to the ship, it is not easy, because you have to maintain a system which is minus 130 degrees Celsius, which is not so easy to do, but it's not so complicated as it could appear at the first glance. So in my view, this is there is a new evolution technology that can completely modify the situation and change completely the I would say the world economy of energy.
Thank you, Paolo. Uwe, do you want
to comment? Yes, only a short answer. This question of energy exchange is already going on. Hundreds of years on the Amur borderline between Russia and China, it was impossible to build up a bridge. 8 years ago, they started to do so. We have just now, I think, 7 or 8 bridges on this Amur River region. Where is going coal from Russia into northern China? Basically, they agreed to build up railway connection. That was the case. And that is going on, and that is continuing. And 2 weeks ago, between Russia and China, they also signed a lot of agreements, including also for free pipelines. Okay. And I think it's quite important that this energy exchange at first needs political understanding, political commercial agreement, and after an investment, and that have to be done. But I think it is on a way.
Thank you very much. Let's move on to other questions. I was wondering, Lewi, my colleague Lewi, do you have a question at this point? No. There's a young gentleman right there. This gentleman here. I have Wolfgang Papa, and I have another person.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Yeah. I wasn't really planning
Please,
on speaking.
Please, can you identify yourself? Very
sorry,
quickly.
Yes. I'm from Energy Childhood Secretariat.
Oh, yeah.
I wasn't planning on speaking, but because like an earlier discussion, so I feel like I have to indulge myself. So so what we do basically is we were established in 1991.
I think
so
just get to the point, please.
But my point is like basically I think why don't I would invite our colleagues here, you know, if you know about Energy Charter Treaty, to maybe know a little bit more. But I think like, you know, I would like to also tell you that we are also expanding into Asia. So I think like, you know, Vietnam and also Philippines are due to join observers. So I think it's would be a useful mechanism for us to share our experience in Europe in terms of promoting connectivity, investment protection, and legal framework and pipelines to really push that into Asia, because energy security is really a fluid thing. Earlier you mentioned, and so when there's insecurity one place, that would also affect Europe. So what I'm saying is we should really consider pushing energy charter into Asia. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for making that very good point. There was a gentleman in front, so we'll keep the microphone on this side for this moment.
Yes, thank you. As Richard heard, I used to be the China economist at the OECD. I'm now a consultant. So one of the panelists mentioned that it was possible to reduce the travel time from 19 days to 14 days if only there were a standard gauge railway from east to west. Now, what do you think the prospects are for such a link through Kazakhstan, for example, or any other routes? Are these feasible prospects at the moment?
Uwe, would you like to?
Yes, of course. We have already different routes. There's an northern route going via Mongolia and Trans-Siberian way. There is a middle road, I would say, going via Kazakhstan, Russia, and Belarus. Already this year started a new road going via Kazakhstan, the Caspian Sea, Azerbaijan and Georgia into the Black Sea. And of course we are expecting in a few months also a road which will go via Kazakhstan or Kyrgyzstan, Iran into Africa, into Oman or into the Emirates. That is developing. If you're asking, okay, this different 1425 rail ways, it is not a technical problem in a moment, and also in the future. The problems we have already are administrational problems, as we heard it, yeah. It is of course a question of administrative barriers, still in documentation, in law, in expectations of some customs procedures and so on. We know we can go from mainland China into Europe in proxy 9 days. That is the optimum. And that is the target for the next few years, and hopefully we can reach this target before 2025.
Thank you very much. I have a question from Wolfgang here. Could you please take your microphone? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Wolfgang Faber. I'm now with CEPS, previously with the European Commission. I would link up directly to this point you just made. The EU is known for its uniqueness as overcoming national borders. The sovereignty pooling and all this, which we have evolved since the 1950s. This is not the case on the way from Asia to Europe. You have to cross national borders. And I wonder if you could quantify, as you just did, in terms of time of travel, how much these national borders in between are an obstacle, and could you quantify even the cost of that? Thank you.
Of course, national borders are still an obstacle. And there's also existing still some problems of integration in the Eurasian Union. That is this new area between Kazakhstan, Russia and Belarus. And we are in a quite good, I would say, communication about it. But on the end of the day, it will be a question of digitalization. That means that we can change all the information, but needs also the customs clearance processes, what needs the officials, what needs the juristical institutions inside via a digitalized change of information. And that is the case, and that is the key, I think, in the next few years.
Thank you for that. Yes, please, Mirjank.
Yes, just to add to this, several years ago we had pilot projects where we measured the border stopping time for container block trains coming from Asia and going through nowadays EU countries on the east of Europe, I don't want to say which ones. Now, it turned out that at some borders, freight train, block train, which should not be kept long, stayed 45 minutes to 50 minutes, and at certain other border would stay 6 hours, 8 hours, 12 hours. Now, there are calculations, I don't want to be quoted because I don't know exact figure, but there are calculations which says how much each hour of stopping a whole train costs the economy. And they're huge, I know. So, yes, you are right. Technically, the problem of different gauges is not a problem because it can, you know, easily be solved and the solutions exist already. But all the other controls that are imposed by railways or on railways are still persistent. And railways, as you know, are a very old system and they change very slowly. You know, there are many other issues related to railways, unlike other modes of transport, that stop them. Thank you.
Thank you. Henrik.
No, just a couple of couple of points to add. I mean, I very much agree with the previous speakers, also from the point of view that the most significant bottleneck that we have is related to the crossing of the borders and the customs procedures and the efficiency of that. That is very much up to the political will of the countries in question. It is not so much of a technical issue. I mean, the technical solutions are all there, but it's just that for different reasons, quite a number of the countries there on the way have simply not been interested in making the crossing of the border more efficient. And until that happens, we are going to have unnecessary delays, and we are not going to have the fastest route. I mean, as you said, Uwe, I mean, it's potentially up to 9 days, and you know, the Russian railways even has the project of transit 7 days, so they think that they can even speed it up. But then, you know, it depends. I mean, like, for example, one of those borders, like the Mongolian border, you can have a situation that on one day it all goes smoothly. On the other day, the train is stopped for the next 48 hours without any explanation. So I mean, these are the kind of issues that we faced. And perhaps also there's also one other element which comes up when we all talk about the rail freight to Asia, and that is also, well, there are two elements. The quality of the tracks, which needs significant investment, especially if you choose to have the route which goes via Russia, and where the investments for the moment are not that easy to come, also because of the lack of financial resources to be put there, even though there have been plans. The plans have not been really materialized, and that actually takes down significantly the speed of the freight train when going through Siberia. And the other issue is also something which is to be mentioned. It's the issue about the security and the investments that you have to make to that respect. So for the smooth functioning, there are many different players who have to contribute to that so that it can really run seamlessly. But as the Deutsche Bahn's example is also, it actually is a growing business, and it's actually a business which has a very good business case to be made.
Mm. I'll give the floor later to all of the other panelists as well, but that brings us to Ambassador Jiang's point about a working group with multi-stakeholders. I have now four questions. So I'm going to take the questions in one go. So the gentleman over there, the gentleman here, Peter, and then Eva. Yeah.
Hello, everyone. I'm Kumar Gaurav from Embassy of India in Brussels. I have a very short comment and a question. The comment is, ASM has largely been called as talking shop or, you know, photo op even mostly, most of the times, because this has hardly been very visible in neither in Asia nor in Europe. And its place has been mostly taken by, let's say, APEC or European Council. Mm-hmm. So my question is basically, why don't we have something like a ministerial group or some joint working group where concrete proposals are proposed and they are acted upon, rather than just being a talking shop and doing nothing about it? Thank you.
Thank you. That is exactly what's in the pipeline. That's exactly what we're talking about. So thank you for that very, very pertinent comment. Gentleman over here, excuse me, I've got both of you. Yeah. Very quick and snappy, if you don't mind.
Thank you. Roland Gebel from the University of Louvain. Thank you to the panel and to the Friends of Europe for explaining clearly the issue about the connectivity infrastructure. But there is also another kind of infrastructure, another kind of connectivity infrastructure, which is vital to all other type of infrastructure, is the satellite infrastructure. Basically, for the satellite telecommunication, for the satellite navigation, and also for Earth observation. And these are very important issues which are already addressed by the European Union, especially in the framework of the Galileo and Copernicus mm-hmm. programs, and also by the fact that two of the most important telecom satellite operators are based also in Europe. So there are many possibilities of cooperation between Europe and Asia for this kind of vital infrastructure, which are complementary to all other infrastructure, are these matters already addressed by ASEM?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for that question. Could you just please pass the microphone to your colleague here? Yeah.
Gerhard Stahl, a professor at the Peking University. Before I was European civil servants, the last 10 years Secretary General of the Committee of the Regions. My question concerns the last step of making the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank operational and linking this question to the difficulty of the regulatory framework. Because one of the issues to make this bank operational is also to decide about the standards, how this bank will function. And this means that questions related to impact assessment, transparency of documents, access for information, all those things which are part of the standards of multi-financial institutions have to be now agreed. And I know that if, for example, the European Investment Bank, which also is already active since quite some time in China, would be invited to join the Asian Infrastructure Bank, they only can do it if their standards are applied for projects also then linked to the cooperation with a new bank.
Thank you.
So my concrete question is, what procedures are envisaged to make sure that until the end of the year, where it has to be clarified how the investment bank works, that these regulatory discussions between different actors are well underway? That means how to assure that the regulatory difference is already now on the table and to avoid that standards are taken for this bank, which later on will be in conflict with potential partners. And that's a question obviously to China, but maybe also to member states who are part of the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank.
Thank you very much. I think it's no secret that the EIB is in fact working quite closely with the AIIB. I think that's already something that's being done. But thank you very much for that question. Eva, please. Just put up your hand, Eva.
Eva Pishova from the EU Institute for Security Studies. My question is very much related to the two previous ones, and it's the implementation, the concrete implementation of this. We're talking about the regulatory convergence. There will be a need for capacity building between different ports in terms of security, safety, between the transportation agencies. What do you think would be the best platform for this? Is it going to be ASEM? Is it, you mentioned, Ambassador Zhang mentioned the cooperation between the AIIB and ASEM. That's a good idea. And whether we are actually heading towards an institutionalization of the One Belt, One Road, in a way.
Thank you very much, Eva. Peter?
Kia ora tato, Peter Kell, New Zealand, Senior Official for ASEM. My question is a very simple one. My interest is to know how ASEM can realistically add value in this space. So I would like to ask, what one recommendation would you make to ASEM as an entity, and what would the reason be for that? Thank you.
That was my question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I'm joking. That's the question I wanted to ask. Well, thank you very much, Peter. So I think this is the question for panelists, this question about visibility, satellite technology, and then the overarching question of regulatory convergence, connectivity, and whether we're institutionalizing OBOR. I think, Muirdrag, would you like to start? And then I give the floor to each one of you. We do have coffee in about 3 minutes, so I'm going to be quite disciplined.
Okay, well, I may not be the best person to start, but I will.
That's why you're starting. You are the best person.
Yeah, yeah, thank you. I want to say something on satellite thing, cooperation. I don't know about the cooperation, but I tell you that there is competition there. And this is one of the problems, perhaps, that I see in my area. There are different systems, GLONASS, Marco Polo, and the competition exists when it comes to application on the earth, on the ground. This is a bigger problem than the lack of cooperation. This competition prevents cooperation. On the converting into institution, the thing is that I think we heard today a lot of good points, perhaps for potential agenda that could be promoted by us. I was in Riga at the transport ministers meeting. There was also ministers of education meeting. So I think that the sectoral cooperation is there. People are working. Perhaps ASEAN could look at the cross-cutting issues in a way where there is no sectoral opportunities for sectoral cooperation to work. In other words, it may not be wise to step on other, you know, turfs and meddle there, but look at the connectivity between different sectors and work on that. On the bank, I cannot say anything. I believe that the countries, there are a number of countries which joined already, European countries and other countries, that joined Asian Investment Infrastructure Investment Bank. And I think that this will be a matter of national, apparently, a national competency and the right of each country to decide for itself.
Thank you. Uwe? I'm not going linear. I'm going the opposite way of how I started.
I would answer, what can ASEAN do? And as I'm feeling as a member, or as I'm feeling as a businessman, or as I'm feeling as somebody who is trying to develop the connection between people, I think bring people together to a dialogue from the different countries. That is very, very important. And it is not only important to speak, it is important to trust each other. And to trust each other means we have to explain what are our targets, and we have also to understand what are the targets, especially also from our Chinese colleagues. To explain the new Silk Road, what is quite easy, have a picture in our head which is different from the picture of our Chinese colleagues, that we have to understand. And also the acting of our Chinese colleagues, we have also understand. And we have to find the common interest of both sides. And that is a quite good target also for ASEAN.
Thank you very much, Paolo.
May I just say something a little bit about the basic question, that is money, about the banking? Because I have a little bit, I'm a little bit obsessed by this distinction between financing and funding. We have invented a lot of banks, but banks are entities that anticipate some money and then they want the money back. And at the end of the day, the money is only provided by the state, by taxes, or by customers. Well, even in this worldwide perception that we have about this kind of relation, we have to identify who is about to fund what we are in. Because if it is enough strategic as to be considered by the states, by the public, which means that the taxpayer is paying that, that's something which has to be very clear stated, has to be, everybody has to know who is paying for that as a taxpayer. And also somebody else has to know who is paying as a customer. Because it seems to me that sometimes we don't go too far. I don't want to say something. Well, that's my, I don't say objection anyhow. My, I would say, I don't feel too comfortable. Even the Juncker plan is the same things. Everything is fine as far as you talk about financing. But at the end of the day, I want to understand who is paying, which means is a taxpayer or is a customer. Because it's happened that everybody's looking, those responsible for taxpayer, the government, say that, okay, that will be paid by the customers. And the customer think they will be paid by the taxpayer. And in the meantime, we are talking more than producing things. Okay.
Thank you. I think Henrik is well placed to perhaps give an answer.
Well, I thought that I will restrain myself only for the general comments. In the end, I mean, if you start talking about money, you can talk endlessly, and there is never enough of it as well, especially when you talk about the infrastructure investment, so there is nothing new there on the world. But I think one of the very important points which was made and also which was reflected in a number of questions is about the regulatory convergence. And this is a process. I mean, this is something which it doesn't happen overnight, and it doesn't happen sometimes at all. I mean, there are different traditions, and there cannot be an entirety in the regulatory convergence. But certainly, through some process, it's possible to get further. And this is something which anyway there are different forms of formal dialogues which are taking place between the European Union, yes. For example, European Union China, for example, European Union and ASEAN and so on. I mean, and there, of course, the regulatory convergence different parts of the economic cooperation are being discussed, and also progress is being made. I mean, this is not something that you can solve in the framework of ASEM, for example. I mean, and in that respect, the question what and how ASEM can add value, I think it is a very good form of a confidence-building forum, which also has already shown that it can add value through the different meetings and also the conclusions which have been drawn, and has also helped to build this confidence, which is obviously the basis for the further cooperation and hopefully also for a more intense relationship between EU and the Asian nations.
Mm. Thank you very much indeed. Ambassador Zhang, clearly all eyes are on China. Well.
Yes, I think I would like to make two observations. The first one is just now some friends mentioned perhaps the ASEM can have more dialogue, and that's the strong point of the ASEM. I would like to add something and build on that. That is, I think it's a high time for ASEM to act, to go to actions, because already almost 20 years passed. Now, within the ASEM, people can only understand each other deeper and better through acting together, through the joint efforts. Otherwise, still, you see, there is some sort of different cultures and misunderstandings cannot be, you see, tackled if there's no actions, actual cooperations taking place on the ground. This is the first point. So the second point is just now the mention has been made of the best practice by the would-be AIIB. According to my understanding, according to my meeting with Secretary General Mr. Jin for AIIB, he made that very clearly to me, that is certainly when the AIIB formally entered into force, certainly the best practice nowadays in the world would be adopted. That's no question at all. Everything would be done according to the highest standards, international standards nowadays in the world. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Andres, please.
Well, I think I will be a little bit repetitive, but I will stress again that ASEM, I don't agree with those who believe that this is just a talk show, that this is just a kind of talking laboratory. This is, I think, one of the few institutions these days who promote the most precious commodity, which is trust. Mm-hmm. And as I indicated, even during these geopolitical situations, those ASEM ministerials brought together ministers which probably wouldn't have been able to meet in different circumstances. And I think this exclusive nature of organization is also very important. I am very happy that we have talked a lot about China, but ASEM is not only about China. And when we speak about those transcontinental multimodal corridors, we should not forget also India and Afghanistan and other countries. And I don't see any other platform where discussions on such a wide range of issues could take place. So I'm not trying to polish and sort of put under the carpet difficulties. They are definitely there. But by working together, we can increase prosperity, confidence, peace, and basically make our countries more prosperous and safe. Thank you.
Thank you, Andres. Thank you. And I think that's a great way to end what has been really a very fascinating discussion. I'm not going to try and wrap it up because I think their ideas stand for themselves and your questions as well. But I think I started off by saying that a discussion on connectivity could be a good way of reviving ASEM. And I think, Andres has said as well, I think this is going to be something very, very important leading up to Ulaanbaatar. I said also, you know, this is an incubator of ideas. And I think here we have heard a number of very important ideas. And the challenge, of course, is going to be to move from vision to action to practicalities. And we've discussed those as well. But I really do wish you well in your endeavors, because I think this is going to be a very important topic for all of us. I'd like you please to join me in thanking our absolutely fabulous panel. Really good insights from all of them. And please join us for a cup of coffee, tea now. And then we have our second panel, which is about institutions, people, and ideas. So things that were not discussed now will be discussed later. We'll be back at 4:00. Please try and be punctual. Thank you.